And it seems like everybody in the neighborhood has like this, like, it's almost like a symbiotic type of relationship where it's just like they like throw bread out for them occasionally and they could just come by and like pick worms and like fertilize whatever birds do, aerate the ground. And then they just like bounce and nobody bothers them. Everybody just like sits on their stoop or sits on their porch and they just watches like these birds. And they're blackbirds, which is like, wow. It's like the only time a bunch of white people watch like black things at peace.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Wow. I need to write that down.
Welcome to the What is Black podcast, where we attempt to defy the myth of a black monolith. I'm your host, Jason McCoy. This podcast wouldn't be possible without your listenership, so please subscribe to us on all the podcasting platforms, including Apple Podcast and Spotify, and share with your friends and enemies. What is Black Podcast is kept independent and ad-free thanks to your donations, so please find all the links on how you can help us keep this going by visiting whatisblackpodcast.com. Without further ado, let's break on in. What's up, everybody? Jason McCoy is back again, and I'm here with Carrie Fagan. Say what's up to everybody, Carrie.
Hey, how's everyone? Hello, hello, world.
So I want to know, like, first I'll check in with you and like see how you're doing.
Man, I'm grateful. You know, we were all affected, as you saw on the media and on the news. Mainly our water went out for about 5 to 6 days. Luckily, our power, our heat and our internet didn't go out. So that's why I say I'm grateful that, like, you know, at least it wasn't as bad as it could have been. And I mean, I've been without water before. I mean, we had the hurricane, the Harvey hurricane. We had to evacuate for that and we didn't have water. So that didn't really worry me too much. But it was very, very uncertain and very random. Mm-hmm. I mean, another thing, we were prepared with the food just by irony. Like, we were already prepared. So that was nice. My family, they were affected, but they're bouncing back. They're doing well. They're doing fine. My friends are good. People are still affected though. People are still we just had a rolling blackout like 2 days ago. So right. It's still going on.
Yeah. That's the thing too, is like, especially in the media, is like, they don't cover it seemed to be just like they cover the immediate thing that happens and that, but they never like follow up with the aftermath of like everything, like how people are like rebuilding or reconstructing after something like that happens.
Yeah. People are waiting in lines for grocery stores still. And like, you know, simple needs, like it's pretty wild. The world we live in is pretty wild.
Yeah. It's like, these last 4 years have been like the mirror. Like, I mean, the mirror has been held up constantly and like everybody throws up blinders, but like, it seems like trial after trial after trial after trial. And it's made more like immediate since we have access to information, like in a Thanos snap, basically we could have anything like in front of us. So like, while it seems like it would make more sense that we would be coming together, given that how much access we have to each other, but it also feels like we're drifting even further apart in that ability to come together.
Yeah, it's really uncertain times. I think, I mean, fear has definitely been a big, big overcast for us all. I mean, we don't even know what's going to happen tomorrow. Mm. You know, we're all in this kind of waiting room, wondering what's next or when does normalcy come back again? It's kind of exciting, but it's also just very unusual.
Yeah, because like I honestly can say like I've never felt more creative or excited to create than like. the, like when the like pandemic hit, and like I spoke with my therapist about it a lot, and I was just like, am I like addicted to calamities, or like do I like get off, or am I like on like tragedy? Because when the pandemic hit, I was like, I mean, everybody was just like, all right, I'm gonna learn how to bake bread and like all types of shit. And but like when it hit me, I was just like, you know what? I am seriously going to partake in all those projects I said I was going to partake in. And I was able to hold myself accountable. And I think that's the main thing. It's just like I had the time where it's just like, all right, it's just me. If I don't do it, I have no excuse but myself.
Yeah, I'm with you on that, like 1,000%. I think this, when quarantine started, it, of course, like we were all panicked. We were all worried. I was scared. I mean, as a freelancer, I was traveling and getting gigs, and this whole quarantine halted all of that. And I was worried about my financial security. But then I was like, wait, I have time to do other things and hold myself accountable, as you said. And I think this is a call to action. You know, what are you going to do with this time now that you have it? I mean, essentially it is uncertain, but we're granted with so much time now to learn ourselves. I mean, I kid you not, before this call, I'm piecing together an album that I'm going to come out with next month. And I just started getting into music when quarantine started. And I built my own studio, and here I am trying to piece together an album. And I never thought I would do that before this whole thing happened.
Right.
I was scared of doing music.
Yeah. I'm going to start teaching myself how to use Blender so I can start making things in 3D. Cause I do a lot of like 2D art. And I was just like, I'll never do 3D art. Like, I don't want to, it's just not my like medium and how I want my things to look. But now it's just like, I kind of want to learn Blender. And so like now I'm just going to teach myself how to do like 3D art. And it's funny that you mentioned that you're getting into music, because while I was looking at your work again, like your photography, your sculptures and the videos, I started to go down this rabbit hole of music. I started to make a mixtape inspired by your work. And with Denise Williams. Let's Hear It for the Boy, that song. I don't know if you know that song, if you're familiar with it.
I need to hear it.
Okay. I might just like do a screen share, or you can like check it out later. But like Denise Williams is kind of like required listening. It's an old song from the 80s. And it's just so happy. Like it just makes you feel good like about it. And you're just like, fuck yeah, let's hear it for the boy. And then it went from there to like, to Lisa and the Cult Jam. So like basically I did like an 80s thing. I went up through an 80s pit, and then I came back up to Blood Orange.
Ooh, man, I was just listening to Blood Orange last night.
Yeah. Like every time I'll go through periods where I forget that Blood Orange and like Dev Hynes exist. I'll just like forget they exist. And then something will remind me, and then I'm just like, yo, I need to go back and listen to Blood Orange. And then it's always like the first song I go to is like, you're not good enough. And I'll watch that video on repeat like 8, 9, 10 times in a row, to the point where it's just like it's an earworm in my wife's ear. And I walk into the room and she's humming it, and she has no idea why she's humming it. And it's just like, it's because I played that video like 8 times. Like, I just love that vibe.
I was just listening to, I did the same thing where I was like, I haven't heard him in a while. And then the first song I played was Orlando. And man, the intro to the beat, man, it's a good nostalgic feeling. I mean, I was listening to it with some friends, and it felt like a sense of normalcy, actually. We all got to kind of enjoy our time with music with my friends. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. So like, inspired by you, I'm gonna like continue on this journey and maybe like come out with a mixtape with like all these like songs inspired by doing research on your work. Yeah, I'll put it up on Spotify and share it with you.
Listen to some Sun Ra.
I'm over.
Sun Ra, where Air is cool in the game.
Yep. Sun Ra was from like I didn't really get into them until like my university days. My roommates were like big into like that, like the like old school like funk scene and all that. And then like Sun Ra came up and it was just like, oh shit. And they actually turned me on to it.
Yeah, Bobby Caldwell.
I can go Which on. Which cracks me up. There was that video about Bobby Caldwell that nobody knew he was white.
Yeah, I know. It's funny. Yeah. I actually tweeted him once, like a few years ago. He responded and he was about to come out to Houston and like give me tickets to see him perform.
Oh, word.
But he, I think something changed, something happened, but just the interaction was like, wow.
Right. That is wild. Responded. Yeah. Did you hear his new project?
No.
Yeah, he's got like a newer project that came out in like, I think, I want to say like 2000, like maybe like 2010, 11, 12. It's him collaborating with somebody else. I have it saved in my playlist. I don't remember the name of it, but it's like him and it's still Bobby Caldwell. It's still like old school, but like the music is a bit more modernized. So yeah, it's just, it's kind of a mind fuck when you listen to it. Cause you're just wait, where am I? what time period am I in? But it's dope. I dig it. Like I listened to it like heavy. It was heavy rotation for a couple of days while I was working.
I'm going to have to check it out then.
Yeah. And if I remember it, like I'll share it with everyone, but like definitely check it out if you can like find the name before I remember it.
Okay.
So one thing going through your portfolio and the, like the work that you've done is you have a theme of chairs, and we might have like a different relationship with chairs, but it's also like there's a common inspiration with them because, and I'm not even, I shit you not, like my first sexual awakening when I was a young like kid was a chair, because my grandmother had these like old and like antique chairs that she would just like paint over and over and over again in her dining room, and they were like super ornate, like they were carved and like they had like all like those like curves and everything like that. And like I remember like I would crawl underneath the dining room table and just like feel up these chairs like for like hours on end, and like I became infatuated with the chairs, and I would just like rub them up and down. I would dig my fingers in between the carving. I don't even know, because I'm not a furniture designer, but like how they were carved to be so ornate. So like and they had like fleur-de-lis carved into them and everything like that. And I would like trace them with my fingers. So it was like this like interesting time and like this affair that I had with chairs. And it like, I never really thought about using chairs as a medium, which is why I found it so interesting that you like use chairs as sculptures. Like you make sculptures using chairs. So what was it that first drew you to using chairs as a medium? And do you think they make a better art medium or sitting apparatus?
So with the first question, what drew me to chairs? I would say that I had a bit of the same experience as you did, where I was always into chairs, but I never knew why I was into chairs. I was just photographing them and really fantasizing just the simplicity of them, but also the characteristics of chairs are all different. And so I started this Instagram account, or I just started taking photos of chairs for years and just collecting the images and really just appreciating, like, you know, you can look at a chair, but it's actually very complex. Like it's not an easy design to make, and no chair is perfect. If you're making a chair, you have to sacrifice one thing. From what I'm learning, you have to sacrifice aesthetic or comfort. And so this all was conjuring up in me. When it finally kind of came out, this was inspired from me burning out with photography. I was kind of tired of the industry and fed up with, you know, just the politics within the industry. And it just led me to want to start something new. And so I went back on that admiration of chairs. Well, when I was traveling, I would, at the airports, I would stack the chairs and kind of leave them there. I thought that was cool. And I started a thing called like a temporary sculpture series, and I would just leave it as a signature. And so zoning back into the present, I was like, well, let me start an Instagram account. Chairs are people. I made that correlation after, you know, telling you like that chairs have different personalities. Well, people do too. And so that simple correlation led to Chairs Are People. And now it's just been an exploration of design. And like today I'm in the process of designing my own chair. I'm now sculpting for different venues. I'm stacking for different venues, and they're asking me to do these performances for them. So it's really interesting. I think the beautiful thing is that I'm using an everyday object, and I'm giving people an abstract view on it. And, you know, everyone has a relation with the chair. And I think the conversation is beautiful. Again, it's something I believe that's bigger than me already, and I'm still learning as I breathe through the process.
And it's always been something, even like in adulthood, like I'm realizing that there's something very sensual about just a simple chair. And like, you know, like finding the chair that fits you is just like kind of like finding the partner that you can be with and just like vibe with for the rest of your life. It's very similar to like finding that right chair that you can like sit in. And when you think about people who are in like abusive relationships, it's very similar to like how people will just sit in a painful ass chair, like whether you like that's because your job dictates you have to sit in this chair or whatever. And they'll just like deal with that pain, and it's like messing up their bodies and like sitting in it. And yet here's this thing that's just like supposed to be there to like comfort you while you're like doing whatever it is you're doing. So it's just like this, it's a very intimate and strange weird relationship that like humans have with chairs, especially given it's not really a position we're supposed to be in for an extended period of time.
Right. Which is very, that's also ironic too. It's not the best, it's better to stand than to sit.
Yeah. Like I have a standing desk, and like I spend most time like sitting still because like standing hurts now because I sit so much. So like I like found it, like I always found like the relationship between like even like humans and like sitting like we and doing things that like pretty much go against our nature, like but like still consistently doing them for comfort. And then that made me think like, well, what is comfort, you know?
Yeah,
which is why I was just like, do you think like chairs are better, like work better for an art medium or a sitting apparatus? Because it's just like when you think about the nature of a chair, it really is hurting you.
Yeah. And there's no such thing out there as the most comfortable chair yet. So, I mean, because all chairs aren't perfect. I mean, I'm trying to get one of those Herman Miller computer desk chairs, but that's an investment.
I know, it's like $1,200 for a chair. It's just like, that's a car payment and mortgage.
but the chair that I'm designing definitely is not comfortable. I believe it's a temporary situation, but I believe it to be more of an artful aesthetic piece. And another thing with chairs is not every chair is meant to sit in too. It can also be a placeholder. And I own over 30 chairs in my apartment, and I put a book on it, and that's perfect for me.
Yeah, I started this installation years ago, back when I was living in New York. It was in collaboration with this gallery in Brooklyn that I'll spare the details of like how the relationship soured, but the installation was I had put chairs on a wall, and like I had them where like the chair legs were on the wall, was the floor, and the chair was facing downward, and I wanted to project like a moving picture or like film onto the ground. So like, here's this thing where it's like, if the audience is walking in, like the chair's on the wall, so they can't sit, but like all the chairs are facing the ground. So it's like implied, like, you know, you go to a movie, you sit down in a chair and you watch the movie, but like, then how can you watch this movie when the chairs are on the wall and the film is on the floor? So it kind of just, I just really want to fuck with people, basically.
I like that idea.
I never got around to finishing it because, again, things happened, like politics happened with the gallery. But I always wanted to, like, in the back of my mind, I always wanted to go back to it. It's just like finding a space to do it and actually like building up the confidence enough to pitch that as an idea, because it's such a departure from the things that I do on the regular.
Hey, I'd love to revisit that with you.
Word.
That's a cool idea, honestly.
Yeah. It was like, and it's always like something that you regret. Like, I'm sure you have like artwork that you just like, damn, I could have just did that. Or maybe you don't. Like, maybe you've like fulfilled like all the artwork that you've, you know, set out to do.
I think with me, yeah, when I say I want to do things, I'm going to do them because my mind is just going to be curious about it until it's done. And it, you know, I can't leave that. Once my mind is set on something, I have to try it at least. I got to try it.
All right.
I've failed so many times that it's like, you know, failing actually teaches you quicker than running away from things.
Yeah. It's like something I preached at this, this workshop that I just gave. To shout out to Braddock Youth Project and the Wilkinsburg Youth Project. And one of the, like, the biggest thing that I told them to take away from anything I said, because I was just like, yo, you can grain of salt everything I said, but the main thing I want you to take away is don't be afraid to fail, because you'll learn more from failing than succeeding. Mm-hmm. And like, I too failed a ton, but can you even call it failure if you can still get something from it?
Right. Like, it's just a word too. I mean, you fail forward is what I learned. Learn to fail forward.
And failure, it's like an interesting thing, because it's something that it's like everyone tells you that you should try to avoid. But I'm just like, nah, right. I'm going to fuck up. And just like, I'll keep it moving.
It's like you can't run away from a thunderstorm, but if you go through it, you know, it'll go away faster.
Right. And it's a dope way to put it. So in sticking with chairs also, there's like a kind of a dichotomy or a balance that runs through all your work too, of like stillness versus movement. And even if it's not those two particular concepts, there's always seems to be like this, like, sometimes delicate balance between the two. So like chairs, for example, like chairs are stationary objects on their own, but like when you stack them, they have this like implied movement. So was that part of your intention, or was that something that just like came about? And is there a rhyme or reason when you're putting things together, or is it the chairs just speaking to you? And you're capturing the chaos.
Okay, I think when I am making these sculptures, I'm giving the chairs a voice. I haven't heard their voice, but I know that when they're in this state, it makes people question. It makes people wonder. It also, for me, gives, it's a very meditative performance. When I'm stacking chairs, I zone out. Everything around me does not exist, and it's very meditating. It's to focus on stillness, to focus on, I mean, I even make mistakes during this process, but when the mistakes happen, to not flinch, to move forward, to be okay, to accept, is part of the meditation. And I just know that I am going to have a finished product. Ultimately, though, I do feel like I'm giving the chairs a voice.
And so now that you've moved to more sculpture work, do you ever revisit photography, or is photography still something that you like have passion for?
With all my medium, all of my mediums bridged together is what I'm learning to appreciate and find out. When I sculpt, I'll document it with my photography, or I'll record it with my video. Photography will never leave my soul. Mm-hmm. My father is a photographer, so him and I always have conversations about photography, and I have plenty of friends who I'm around, and it's like a sixth sense. Something that I feel like I've kind of mastered on my terms, and I'm comfortable moving on to other things. I think music is something, I think with all these mediums that we go into, and I'm sure you can relate to this, like you learn more about yourself. And when you come back to the older things, it's like you kind of repower them with the new things that you've brought back with your other mediums. And that's how I feel like with my music. I feel like when I put this album out, my expression, because I've never used my voice on music. And so this will be the first time that I do that. But when it's out there, I'm going to feel more comfortable to use my voice in that manner. And, you know, going back to photography, talking about my work through expression, like it's not going to be difficult to express that, because I have the ability to sing and to use my voice that way. So I think all mediums bridge and connect.
So what's the most important thing you've learned about yourself in working with all these mediums?
I've learned that I am a Renaissance man. I'm capable of anything. I've learned that I'm a great writer. I've learned that it's like when quarantine started, like you said, I feel like I did more things now than before, and I feel like I've learned that I am ultimately a leader. I know my purpose, definitely. I've found my purpose during this unusual time, and using my voice, I've learned that I'm a very expressive person. I've never taken the time to just sit down and appreciate the things that I do. And this time is like my writing. I used to be so hard on myself writing, because I always thought, well, when you write, I need to have a finished product. But I've learned that even the unfinished things can be the most beautiful. And maybe that is my process. My work is very raw. It can be. Some of my work isn't finished, and that can be beautiful.
So when you're working with people, humans, versus working with like objects, is there a difference in how you approach working with either or?
I think working with
objects is a lot more challenging, because they don't speak. I love talking with people. So when I work with people, I don't like to go directly into working. I like to get to know them. I like to just be friends with someone. It's not always about being creative on the moment. I am a very spontaneous person, but building connection is important for me. Building a narrative. With objects, I also just got into making ice sculptures.
Oh, shit.
And I have one in the fridge right now I'm working on. And it's hard working with objects, photographing them, figuring out how you want them to look visually in a space. I to this day, I challenge myself to find some still life images that I've taken that I enjoy. I think it's still something that I'm learning.
Mm. Yep. So like photography is something that I've always appreciated, but I never understood. There's like something in my head where it's just like, I don't get photography. And most times when I look at a photograph, instead of appreciating like the art of the photograph, I'm wondering more about what's happening behind the scenes. And that's probably from my like film background, but like, I'm wondering like, okay, well, what lens did they use? Like, was that on a tripod or was that the handheld? So I can't appreciate photography for the photograph. I'm always wondering about like the process. And that's the only thing, like the only artistic expression that I do that with, because I can sit and look at something like, say, like the Mona Lisa or whatever, and just like appreciate the Mona Lisa for what it is, and then like start thinking about the process. But I guess like for where other people can just like, oh, that's just some painting of a white lady. Like, I see so much more than that. But like with photography, there's like this block, and I can't get it. So like, I always ask people who are photographers, like, what about photography like drew you in, and what does it take to like make a moment to capture on film?
It's a good question. When I got into photography, as I mentioned, my dad is a photographer. I was following him around and shadowing him while he was doing jobs. And, at the time I wasn't really interested in it, but I was interested in the focus. I was interested in why he was taking photographs, the feeling he got, the numbers, when I was hearing him editing, talk about settings and editing, and like that fascination drew me in. And one day he said, here, try taking photos. And again, the curiosity was there, but I didn't really fall in love with photography. But I'm also in love with repetition, and photography allowed some repetition. And so it started clicking to me. And then me and my father started going out to parks and taking photos of plants and bugs and things in nature. And that's when he showed me the micro lens for the first time. He bought a micro lens, and this lens was like zooming in like very finely on like bees and ants and plants. You could see the details. And that's when I was like, oh, wow, you can do that with photography. And that's when I bought my first camera. I had a Nikon D300S. I didn't go to school for photography. I was self-taught. I think as I was taking photos, I was just in love with the repetition of trial and error, and going back on a photo I took and changing the setting and getting something different.
Mm. And then that's what led to like, like further, like taking more pictures, and then a career, because you shot like some memorable album covers. And it's like when I like see like the A$AP Rocky like album cover, it's like so much different from like, because it's like a familiarity that I felt, because it's just like, a bunch of black dudes just like ganging up in a circle. But then like, it was just so different at the same time. Like I felt it, but I didn't know what I was feeling. Cause again, I don't like get photography. It's just like, so I was just like saying like, this is more like an illustration to me, or like a painting to me. And that's how that's how I could relate it to like it being like a dope work of art. Was I had to break it down. It's just like, oh, okay, nah, this is more like a painting, because it's just like the use of shadow and light and everything like that.
And I think that's an okay way to look at it. I mean, I've looked at my works as to look like a painting as well. So I think that's an okay way to look at photography.
So now then, what made you decide to go like take your photography and make jigsaw puzzles out of them?
Okay, so that I started that 3 years ago, and it was simple. I wanted to find a way to get my work in the hands of people, and a way that people can build. Well, I first said, how can I break my work apart? And so I thought of the puzzle, and at the same time, I'm very into like disconnecting and having balance, getting off of these platforms. So that was one thing. Then I thought, well, this is a way that people can form a relationship with my work, if they know who I am or not. And that's it. That's the simplicity. I mean, and you don't really see Black people on puzzles either. So that was it would be refreshing to see that.
Yeah, absolutely. Because when like I first found out that you did puzzles, I was like, wait, what? And then I looked at it's called Timeless Goods, timelessgoods.store. Yeah. And I was just like, oh shit. Okay. And it was like, I felt somewhat foolish because I'm of the belief, oh yeah, Black people could do anything. But then when I saw your puzzles, I'm just like, wait, Black people and making puzzles and like Black people on puzzles for real? Oh,
yeah.
Okay. That's something I never even thought or imagined, but it's a dope project. And I like this puzzle because it's just like, it's like piecing together. So like you're piecing together this identity, and like, you're also like, you know, piecing together this like narrative in the figurative and literal sense. And then you have this finished product, and then you could just break it apart and start it all over again. Like
I was going to say, or you can frame it. I'd be encouraging people to frame their puzzles. Because then it's not just a poster that you buy. It's now a puzzle in a frame. Like you put it together. You took the time to do that. Now it's on your wall. Like I think it could be sometimes better than just buying a photo itself.
Yeah.
Because it provides the experience.
And you've like, in a certain way, like made it interactive and made the puzzle, the person who was putting it together, a part of the art, like on some subliminal level. It's just like, you are now the artist also, because like you're putting this piece together. So it's just like dope. And it made me want to like explore puzzles, because I'm always trying to find a new way to not just get my own art out, but like to just like get art out and kind of democratize art. Because like, you know, no disrespect to the gallery system, but there's wild issues with the like gallery system, like who gets in, who gets whatever, and like a lot of politics, and I just don't have time for that. I just like making work, so like I'm constantly trying to figure out ways to like just get art out there in a very democratized way. And I started looking into doing more things on the like using the blockchain, like Nifty, and using like Super Rare and other services like that. And it's just like, that's cool. And I'm like, I will eventually do it, but it's also, I want to get people off of digital and more like interactive and tactile and really get to experience like the art. Because again, it's just like having this way for digital artists to sort of shit is dope, but it's also just like expensive and, piece in a frame, like you just throw it up and then that's it. But interactive art, where the person who's like viewing it is also taking part of it, is the direction that I really want to go in. And like seeing your work using jigsaw puzzles as a medium, I was just like, yes, this is dope.
I would love to send you a puzzle.
Man, I'll like, just let me know. Like, I'll pay, you know, whatever. I'll go on the site and buy one. Like, I want to support you as well.
Okay. Well, I'll send you. I got you. I got you. Regardless, I got you.
Okay. We'll work something out at the end of this. Yeah. But like, yeah. So like, I appreciate like, you know, taking out the puzzles, and like, it's also like, it provides like a good inspiration for other people too. It's just like, you know, you put more work on puzzles. And so do you also run the method of production for the puzzles, or do you have that sourced?
We have a factory. We have a private manufacturer that does it for us.
Yeah. And that's dope. Cause so you control like from concept to like finished product.
Mm-hmm. Like go ahead.
No, I was going to say, cause you have your finger, you're able to like quality control and do all that every step of the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's been a blessing. Like how things have been with this Timeless Goods. It's came out of nowhere, honestly. Came out of nowhere, but I'm grateful for it.
Yeah, it's a dope project. And like, I can't speak highly enough of it for like everybody to check out the store. I'll leave links in the description to it as well. I wanted to switch gears and talk about, because you had mentioned earlier that you like, you're a freelancer and you travel a lot and your work has been shown like in different places in the world. So could you speak on your time in Italy and Japan? More specifically, could you speak on your time being Black in Japan and Black in Italy?
Wow. Great question. Great. Yeah. Being Black in Japan, I'd recommend every Black person to go to Japan. I've never felt so safe. I've never felt so safe and so normal. I went by myself and I lived out there for 3 months and I was welcomed. It felt like I already lived there. They already knew I was out there. Of course, there's people out there that may have never seen a Black person before. And that's you're on their land. Like, of course that might happen. And I mean, I've had a few people come up to me and like touch my hair, but it's I'm not going to be offended by that. I'm going to be accepting. Like, they're curious.
Right.
And I'm also studying Japanese. So I'm going to interact with them. I want to know about Japanese culture. So if this is how we're going to interact, like, I could learn something, you know? Mm. And I mean, back to the safety, I being stopped by police in Japan versus being stopped by police in America, man, it's a landslide of a difference. It's a landslide of a difference. The cop in Japan did his job and left me alone. And it's just like, man, well, let me tell you the experience. So I met a mentor out there. He's a monk and he let me borrow his bike at the top of the week. And I was riding around Japan with the bike. They're very big on bike culture out there. So they register these bikes. And okay, a cop might have thought I stole a bike. He's never seen a Black person on a bike, so he's going to stop me. That's fine. He stopped me. He did the registration. I was able to tell him, like, in Japanese that I was borrowing a bike from a friend. But as soon as I told him that, and as soon as he realized, he actually apologized to me. He said, sorry. I apologize. I'm sorry. And he smiled at me and waved me goodbye. And I was like, that's it? Okay. Nice.
Like, yeah.
It's sad that I felt that way, but like, man, it was so simple. He did his job. Japan is a beautiful place. I always tell people that I left my soul out there in the most beautiful way. I'm going to go back and get it. It's just a place I think I belong. I actually flew to Japan because I was tired of being familiar with everything around me.
Mm.
And I think this was my kind of awakening trip. You know, we all have those times where we just need to get out and find ourselves. And I think I really found myself in Japan. The first time I went, I didn't do a residency. It was just for exploration. And then the second time when I went back, that's when I did my residency with Chairs Are People. And that was my first time showcasing that idea publicly to people. know, because before it was just admiration and something I kept on paper and behind the scenes, but they were very, very accepting of this. They've never seen it before, but they were very accepting of it. And it being black in Italy is kind of the, I wouldn't say the opposite, but there is a little subtle racism out there, and that's unspoken. And you know, if you're black in Italy, they're gonna think you're selling something. And it's sad because I think the people that are out there selling things, they're captured, and that's like their job, and they can't do anything else but work. And so if you're black and you go to Italy, like, they don't, sometimes they don't acknowledge you. And they don't look at you. They don't say anything to you. They might think you're just trying to sell them something. And they give you mean looks too. That was the first time I actually stopped and got flustered by someone like giving me like a nasty look. And I almost confronted him, but I was like, wait, I'm not in like, this is not my home. Like, I can't really do anything.
Right.
So I got to keep moving forward. Italy's a beautiful place. So I'm not knocking on it, but there, I'd say go to Japan. if you really want to, I think, and that's another thing, I think a lot of black people fear going to Japan by themselves. I was actually one of those people. I had to look up a YouTube video being black in Japan first, right, before going out there.
Right.
But I couldn't base it off of that. It's a beautiful experience. I think they love black people out there. They love black culture. And I'd recommend anyone to go out to Japan.
Yeah, because I think my first time out in Japan was in 2000. Yeah, 2000. And it was right after I left college. So, like, YouTube wasn't even a thing. So it was just like, all right, I'm just going to go out and be black in Japan. And I lived in Kyoto for a year.
Oh, nice.
And I speak highly of Japan also to a lot of people, to a point where people think I'm fetishizing Japan, but I'm like, it's not like loving up on like anime girls or anything like that. It's like Japan is just dope, where it's just like you can have the same instance like you described of like, you know, somebody like touching your hair, whatever. But like if it happens in the States, you're ready to fight somebody. And exactly, but like over there, it's just like it's like and this is not to like infantilize them, but it's like this innocence. It's almost like a childlike innocence because they don't have like the constant exposure. It's like, yeah, they have media, but they don't have that constant exposure to like black culture. So it's like, I was way more open to like not being like, you know, molested or anything like that, but like I was way more open to like, you know, with my physical person there than I am over here. I feel like I'm over in the States, I'm like constantly guarded, but like over there,
over your shoulder, it's like,
yeah,
second. Yeah.
And it's just like, and I also think it's just like for like, especially like when it's an interaction with a white person, it's just like, you know, black people, like, you know, black people, there are black people in your country. There have been for years and years and years. There's like a whole history month that's dedicated to the black people in your country. But like in Japan, it's not like that. It's just like, no, really, how do you get your hair like that? And so it's like, it feels more genuine. And just being out there, it's like, it was the first time I actually felt like, oh, I'm black, you know, with like in full stop. Whereas like here, it was just like, there's all like the constant pressure of just like, you know, being like black enough or whatever. But also it's just like, oh, well, are you like, what are you like Jamaican? Are you like Haitian? Like, you know, where your people come from and stuff like that. Like here, whereas over there, like none of that matters. It's just like, I'm black. Like, that's it.
Yeah.
And I was able to like just being black, like opened up a lot of doors and just like being able to like meet people. And like, I don't know if it was like similar experience to you, but it's just like you could go in like a restaurant and everybody, you spoke like the littlest bit of Japanese and everybody was so excited for you. And on the one hand, that could seem like almost fetishistic. And but on the other hand, it's just yo, I like getting free shit. So if you want to like, you know, give me some beers and get drunk with me, or you want to like, yo, try this sushi, like, oh shit, you can use chopsticks. And like, I'm like all for it.
I had a pretty crazy experience that I tell people all the time. This is really what like made me fall in love with Japan. They're big on onsens out there, the onsen culture. And one time I went to an onsen when I was finished, they had the lounge where they have the vending machines. You can kind of rest up before you leave. I was sitting out there just getting ready to leave. And this family comes out because they just finished. It was like father, the wife, the son and the daughter. And so the daughter came up to me, or they all got ice cream. They all got ice cream. And the daughter came up to me with her ice cream, stood right in front of me. I was just sitting down, like just minding my own business, like, you know, on my phone. And the daughter came up to me and she was like she put her ice cream out and she was just like, here, like, I want you, like, I'd love to like try this ice cream. And I looked at her like, and her family came up to me and they were like, try it. Like it right. looks, it's good. Like, and I was like, all right, cool. I'll try the ice cream. And so like that, just that normal exchange, like they smiled. We all like talked about ice cream and like, that was it. They said goodnight.
Right.
And like, if you do that, if a girl came to you in America and like gave you ice cream, like that would be a whole different thing.
Man, I'm just like, where are her parents at? Does everybody see me? Like my hands are up like this. Like I'm not touching this little girl. Like go away from me. Yeah.
But it was such a beautiful exchange because it was just normal. Like they just wanted to share ice cream and have an interaction with me and say goodnight.
Yeah.
And like we don't have a lot of that here anymore.
Nah, not at all.
And it's always like sensitive or you know, an agenda something or jealousy that, or like it's always something.
It's like, and it's interesting too, it's just like with the proximity, because like with Italy, like, you know, the proximity to the entire continent of Africa, but to like Northern Africa and everything like that, like they have, you know, experience with Blacks. It's like Japan is an island that, like, you know, imports basically everything. And yet, like, I feel more accepted there than I do in my own fucking country and like many other like European countries. And it's just wild. Like,
it is wild.
I love Japan too. And again, I don't want anybody, I'm not like fetishizing Japan. I just love going out there and like just being able to chill and like legit chill. And it's just dope. Like music scene's dope. Like food is dope out there. Like when you, if you actually like take the time to put aside like your biases, like Japanese hip hop is actually pretty fresh.
Right.
Like, I met like a few like hip hop acts from Osaka, like Kyoto and Osaka. And I was just
nice.
And it was just dope. Like, you know, just like hanging out with them. And they were like scarier as a motherfucker. Like some of them were like Yankee and some of them were like just straight like gangster ass Japanese dudes. And I'm just like, yo, I'm actually kind of frightened right now, but it was all love. And that's why it was just so fresh, because it was just like there's these scary ass dudes speaking like wild like Osaka Ben and Kansai Ben and just like real thick dialect. And I'm like, I didn't learn this Japanese.
You speak a little bit?
Yeah, I spoke a lot more when I was out there, obviously, because you learn, but like I studied it in university.
Oh wow, okay.
So like I was able to like, that was like even a bigger shock to people that like I was able to speak at the level I was able to speak at, especially being a Black American and not like an African immigrant who went over there. Yeah. But yeah, it was wild to see that it was like all love. And that's not to say it was great all the time, because there was like one time the motorcycle gang was like, I can't remember. Not Bosozoku. Is it Bosozoku? But whatever the name for the motorcycle gangs out there, they're real nationalistic, like Japanese nationalists. And they had like this impromptu kind of like motorcycle parade down one of the main roads. And that was kind of like, huh, that's interesting. And they were just like super like foreigners get out and everything like that. But even that was like polite. It's like these gangster ass dudes on motorcycles were saying like, yo, foreigners get out. This is like, this is Japanese country. And it was mostly like anti Korean and Chinese sentiment. But I was like threatened and at the same time like, oh, thank you.
Wow.
It was wild. So I can go on and on about talking about Japan, but before we go, I wanted to give you a chance to promote anything that you want to promote, plug anything that you want to plug, tell us about what you got coming up, etc.
Yeah. So right now I am putting out a book. Well, it's finished. It's going to be coming out either in March or April. Should I drop the title? Yeah, I will drop the title. It's called The Unfinished Book of Words. And it's just a conceptual book. It's a lot of deep thought, and I don't want to spoil too much, but yeah. I'm going to be working on that for March or April. And I have another installation coming up in March with this company called By George. It'll be my first commissioned install for a retail space. So I'm really excited about that. And it'll be under Chairs Are People under the events tab. And then I'm doing a really big collaboration with the Houston Furniture Bank and Chairs Are People. And right now we're working on creating staff t-shirts for them. And we're about to I'm about to do a lot of volunteer work with them and come up with a project this summer that can help donate and bring audience to the Houston Furniture Bank and what they do and helping providing furniture for families in need in Houston. Dope.
Dope. That's awesome. And finally, what is Black?
That's a great question. Black is infinite. Black is infinite.
Dope. Carrie, thanks for taking the time to speak with us, and looking forward to checking in with you about getting some jigsaw puzzles going.
Hey, we gotta continue these Japanese conversations though.
Oh yeah, most definitely. Like, I'll go at length about it. Like, cause that year I spent total like a year and 3 months in Japan.
Oh, nice.
And
nice.
Like, yeah, it was just like I spent like maybe like two weeks in Tokyo. And then the rest of the time I spent like in Kyoto. So like, yeah, I got like wild stories.